This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of The Sea Image, a panel and book launch featuring architect Keller Easterling, anthropologist Vijayanthe Rao, artist Alex Villar, and artist Hakan Topal, held in celebration of the publication of the book of the same title. The event took place on January 25th, 2012.
Sit here. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming tonight. And first of all, I would like to thank Cabinet crew, Sina Nejafi and Jeffrey Kastner, for having us tonight. And also, I would like to thank our panelists who kindly agreed to be with us tonight. Keller Easterling, Vijayanthe Rao, Alex Villar. And unfortunately, Güven İncirlioğlu, my art partner and co-editor of the book, couldn't be here. And he was going to participate via Skype from Istanbul. But he's renovating his studio, and he doesn't have internet access, so he apologizes, but he sends his greetings to you, and after the panel in the reception, we'll cheer for him. So the seas have always been kind of a source of inspiration for artists and writers, and represented some sort of puzzle for like art histories. And was it ever possible to look into the sea as it is? This appears to be an old problem. So the science of oceanography, with its subdivisions of marine biology, chemical oceanography, ocean geophysics, and other hybrid subjects, it's somewhat older than the space exploration, but not older than astronomy or cartography. In fact, depth of oceans and the abyss are time and time again compared to space, the real final frontier. During the industrialization, infused with national pride and colonial aspirations, empowered with scientific and industrial will, sea represented a frontier to be conquered. But its awesome powers could never be tamed. I mean, when I talk about sea and ocean, I always think about Mediterranean Sea. I mean, I'm coming from Turkey, and Mediterranean Sea kind of haunts us as a sea that is as a historical territory. And of course, for Ottomans, and their relationship with the Europeans has always been with the battles. Sea was always a battleground. But sea also is a kind of amusement park in certain cases. This is a miniature that I found online. It is from the Naval Museum from Istanbul. Sea is also fun. So Abraham Ortelius was a Flemish cartographer and geographer, recognized as the creator of the first modern atlas called Theater of the World. Ortelius is best remembered for his ability to gather an immense body of existing geographic knowledge and to publish it in a consistent and high-quality cartographic format. Of course, these maps are drawn with the sea monsters and imaginary creatures, with battles and waves and people drowning. Perhaps all these creatures were part of the theater of the world, as those mythic beasts. Of course, today, when we look at the sea, when we imagine the sea, there is this touristic articulation of the monster, right? This Loch Ness monster in Scotland, or recently there was a monster in eastern part of Turkey in a small lake, in a big lake. They try to imitate the success of the Loch Ness Monster, I suppose. But among these imaginary monsters, there are real monsters, like in the depth of the oceans. And then when we look at them, since they are real, they don't capture our imaginations as well. So today, we look at the sea much differently. We know a lot, but its unknowability still haunts us. This project, this image is showing Dutch artist Bas van Ader sailing. Ader was lost at sea while attempting a single-handed west-east crossing of the Atlantic in a 13-foot pocket cruiser. The passage was part of an art performance titled In Search of the Miraculous. After a while, radio contact broke off, and the boat was found after 10 months, floating partially submerged 150 miles west-southwest of the coast of Ireland. His body was never found. Of course, I mean, like when we were doing this project, we knew that there were a lot of projects has been done in and around seas. So this project by Ursula Biemann, who could also participate us for the book project, researches about the Sahara Basin as a continuity of the Mediterranean Sea. She focuses on African immigrants who are trying to move from south to north, from Africa to Europe. And this project is also part of the book by Relu de Vries. The person who's looking, an inhabitant of Jir az-Zarka, is a village located in a swamp area on the coast of Mediterranean Sea. And the village was inhabited by Bedouins for more than 400 years. De Vries analyzes the forced transformation of the village, first by a modern coastal highway was built next to the town, then second, government employs environmental discourse and techniques and preservation to declare the coastal frontier of the village as a preserve. So the village is effectively contained and controlled by the series of man-made fences and structures. And this project, of course, Alan Shakula, and we all know him from his project Fish Story, 1995. And recently, they made a film with Noel Birch, The Forgotten Space, looks at the globalization and the sea, and then sea as a terrain, basically, to analyze what's happening on the sea, in and around the sea, and the containers and the shipment. So the sea image, the book that we are presenting today, is the final outcome of a visual project, research project that we started in 2009. As the final leg of our project, we organized a symposium, an exhibition in Istanbul, December 2010, that brought together a small international group of artists, scholars, and writers. The symposium titled Sea of Marble, a Navigational Convergence, took place at Antrepo, the old warehouse in the port of Istanbul. Participants of this symposium included Ursula Biemann and Shuruk Harp, T.J. DeMoss, John Palmesino, Vajayanti Reo, Alex Villar, Relu de Vries, and our project partners, Peter Mortenberg and Helge Munzhammer. Since I'm going to cover for Gwen tonight, I'm going to cut the introduction a little bit shorter, and I would like to move to our participants. Tonight, Keller Easterling, Vyjayanti Rao, and Alex Villar Vidas. Keller Easterling is an architect, urbanist, writer, and professor at architecture at Yale School of Architecture. In fact, when we were thinking about our project, when we started our project, we immensely benefited from Keller's research. But unfortunately, she couldn't come to the symposium in Istanbul, and I'm glad that she is here today among us. Her latest book, Enduring Innocence, Global Architecture and Its Political Masquerades, researches familiar special products that have landed in difficult or hyperbolic political situations around the world. The book won Yale's Gustav Ranis Award for Best Book by a Yale faculty in 2005. Her previous book, Organization Space, Landscapes, Highways, and Houses in America, applies network theory to a discussion of American infrastructure and development formats. Vyjayanti Rao is an assistant professor of anthropology at the New School for Social Research. She works on cities after globalization, especially in the intersection of urban planning, design, art, violence, and speculation in the articulation of contemporary global city. She is the author of numerous articles on these topics and is currently working on a book titled The Speculative City. Alex Villar, a longtime collaborator, of mine, is a Brazilian artist based in New York. His work draws from interdisciplinary theoretical sources. It employs video installation and photography. His individual collaborative projects are part of a long-term investigation of potential spaces of dissent in the urban landscape, which has often taken the form of an exploration of negative spaces in architecture. He exhibited at numerous venues, including New Museum, Mass MoCA Drawing Center, Exit Art, Museo de Arte Moderna in Sao Paulo, and Alex is going to be the first presenter of tonight. Thank you.
Great. I just wanted to show you this piece first. It's going to be a very, very short talk. Usually what I do is to show some of the examples of the work that I do, so you can kind of understand how I build up my language, but there's not much time for me to go into there today. I just wanted to start with this piece, which I did recently, something that I did since the symposium about a year ago. And what I do normally is to try to construct a situation in which you can begin to build some divergency from an established path. Say, for example, what do you do when you go from work to from home to work using the subway? You would, you know, go by the stairs and then find your way into there. So I developed a piece in which I'm caught in between the negative spaces of that trajectory. So in several pieces that I did, I'm always trying to find this kind of adjacency to established path. So if I were to synthesize it, in a way, the project is to find an adjacency to power, and power being understood simply in Foucauldian terms as those kind of reiterative movements that we do in that form us in what we are. So I'm always trying to construct this slight difference, this kind of slippage. This time, what I tried to do is something slightly different, which is to put the two of them together. So this is the same trajectory. It's basically a trip by ferry from Wall Street to Greenpoint. And you can understand that as being the trip that a commuter takes. For example, someone who works in Wall Street and now and lives in Greenpoint or across the river, usually one of those beautiful buildings that they begin to build on that side. There are also tourists that use that boat, but primarily you find those commuters. So what I did there then is to segregate that trip into parts. There's one part that only sees the newly renovated landscape, this beautiful harbor now near Dumbo, you know, some of the beautiful buildings there, you know, it goes comfortably inside the cabin. And on the other side, everything begins to be a bit more difficult. The landscape, it's the remnants of the industrial cityscape that is still in place, and you're not inside a cabin, you're outside of it, and you have to negotiate the water and the river and so on. So just those two experiences juxtaposed. The reason why I'm bringing that to show you in this context is because I usually, like about a year ago, was reading quite a bit and issues that I kind of outlined for the symposium. One of the things that interests me the most was migration trajectories across the ocean. And the more you read about it, especially if you read the mainstream press, you begin to feel that there's a manner in which those stories are organized. I mean, you could almost call it like a Manichaean framework. I mean, the stories tend to be organized, they either fall in a good or an evil axis. You know, you either have, you know, advanced commodity vessels, or you have, you know, anachronist pirates. You know, you have anything from like amnesty, refugees, to smugglers. So it's always the good and the bad. You know, it's kind of fairy tale in reality, good and evil, all those things kind of organized in that framework. And I was thinking, what does that mask? I think it masks something quite simple, which is a very blatant inequality in this trajectory. And the inequality, it's simply described as an ability to flow through without any obstacles. You know, there are people who have a free pass to go through one end to another. And there are those for which the trajectory itself is the territory of struggle. So this kind of simple binary inequality is masked by this, you know, apparatus of, you know, good and evil and so on. So what I wanted to do is, since my work doesn't comment on, it doesn't reference macro economies in questions of that order, what I try to do is to particularize those issues and create a microcosm of them and look at what is happening in everyday life and some of those issues can be brought to bear. And that's what I did, you know, displaying this situation of inequality in a kind of a simpler framework. So that's basically what I wanted to tell you about this. And if you have any questions or complaints, I could entertain them now.
Can you talk about the project that you did for the book?
And you were going to ask that question?
I haven't finished
that project. What I did is take a little bit of a departure. Also, the reason why this project became relevant for me is because I think you informed that project. I'll tell you kind of in a nutshell. I've been interested in this. Like I mentioned, I was interested in this migrants. In the moment of interruption of that trajectory, it's when the boat sinks and they potentially die in the water. And in such situations, there's no flip side. There's not positive side to that event. It's just disaster. So what I began to do is to look at other experiences in which that moment of the suppression of breeding, which in that case is fatal, can be utilized to resist. And I found that in a practice called static apnea. It's a sport where people just go underwater and they stop breeding and attempt to breed, to stay underwater for as long as they can. There's two varieties. One is they remain still. The other, you know, you swim as further down as you can. But particularly the one that remains still interests me, because if you imagine that, and there are some photographs of people who are practicing there, and if you have a mental image of someone who died underwater, those images are very similar. They just stem from a very different practice. So this kind of pivoting of experiences interests me, and I think the reason I think we informed this, be informed by this project, is because I'm thinking that it's not only that mirror image that I described, but there are other situations too. Like one example that I showed during the symposium there was a scene from a film called Welcome, in which there are migrants attempting to cross the English Channel, and what they do is they go undercover under this inside a truck, and they cover their heads with plastic bag, and they attempt to breathe within so that they can be detected as they are going through. So they suppress their breathing in order to go through. Now, in the film itself already clarifies that their same practice of putting a bag on someone's head is used during sessions of torture. So you see the exact same device, the exact same experience happening in completely different ways. What I found interesting there is that you have suddenly, and even some of the participants in the film, one person in particular, had been tortured in that way, and that's why he can continue to do it. But what is interesting in that narrative for me is how an element that was used for repression can be reversed and utilized for a different pursuit. You find the same kind of thing happen through radical sexual practices. So there's many ways in which those things get flipped. So I started this project, Hakan mentioned, called Breeding Understudy, in which I should tell you as well that all the work that I do, there's a performative element to it. It's about putting the body through one trajectory and seeing how that situation happens in that conjunction. So I began this underwater breeding project, which I think now it's being multiplied in different experiences that will be brought together at one point. That'll be the next moment of that project. But it's essentially that. I'll say one last thing and then I'll go. I mentioned that I'm usually not dealing with very large questions, in a sense, kind of micropolitics, not referencing those matters directly, although I'm very interested in them. What happens in my artistic language is that I particularize them, as I mentioned. But the theoretical source for their thinking stems from kind of Foucauldian thinking of how power is acted through the body. It's that moment of conjunction between power understood of any kind of relationship that may be repressive or not. It's acted through the body and shaping the body, shaping the subjectivity of that body. What is interesting about that is that there's a resilient resistance in that junction. So it's not just a violent gesture of putting a gun to someone's head. It's more a relationship in which the subject also has an ability to kind of redirect there. So that conjunction is what interests me the most. But I'll leave it at that. Thank you, everyone.
Oh, it doesn't matter. See, do we have an image yet?
Let me see.
Is it coming?
Oh, it's coming. Yes. There's something. Yeah.
Well, it was very nice to meet you, Hakan. Congratulate you on your book and. I think I've been asked to give this brief tip of the hat because of that contemplation and enduring innocence about the seas. And I went back to read it a couple of hours ago, and because I'm never really asked to lecture on it or its contents, I haven't actually read it in 1,000 years. So it seemed like something somebody else named Keller had written, but who I will feel obliged this evening to cite appropriately. But it was an index of thinkers who've used the sea as metaphor. And it's interesting because while this book that you have produced, Håkan, and that Contemplation and Enduring Innocence was very, you know, for a relatively specialized audience, and that little contemplation was just a sorbet between different segments of a book. But it is interesting how persistent the image is, and how really you have trouble finding thinkers who have not used a sea metaphor. It's also amazing the degree to which it is a very cooperative metaphor, can be bent to many different purposes. In the Enduring Innocence piece, I was intrigued by, in some ways, was lampooning the way in which the sea lent a kind of epic Deleuzian theme music to some of the late 20th century theories of globalization. You know, perhaps a little florid, a little overdramatic, of the seas, the sands, the atmospheres, you know, modeling a political disposition for market activities where a market was able to slosh over territorial boundaries, or where a market behaved like bands and pacts, all the Deleuzian metaphors, right? Also interested in the way that the sea modeled dispositions and properties that were related to the heroics of either empires or enemies and innocents. So in that piece, again, not exactly lampooning, but looking at Virilio and Deleuze and De Certeau and Hardin Negri, all that same family of thinkers for whom you can always somehow hear a kind of muffled clank of armor as offstage noise. Something about the sea lends to them a kind of epic for their own theories. And with all these thinkers, the singularity of the sea is emphasized as, you know, aligning with Deleuze's kind of monistic philosophical disposition. You know, it is mother, it is femme fatale. The piece also noted the ways in which the left and the right use the sea as a medium of political or economic liberalism. You know, in the neoliberal portrayal, globalization is a frictionless sea carrying virtual packets of information in one world and all the rest of it. The sea naturalizes the human right to a frictionless free market. And alternatively for the super Marxists, the sea is the site of the biopolitical groundswell. That possesses some potential to utterly disrupt market forces. Same sea. So quoting the Keller person who wrote that, at some point there's a sort of impatience where it says, to believe that any of these maritime songs are liberatory reveries of a warm and amniotic sea, talk about dramatic, approaching homeostatic equilibrium, frictionless resistance or spectacular revolution, is to bump up against the side of the tank. And I think it was bumping up against the side of the tank, which is what I wanted, to find not a smooth sea, but a slushy sea, and a sea that was hard and bloody, even though it masquerades as something that's smooth and free and soft, but is really filled with elastic but very taut and sometimes impenetrable partitions. So the book, I guess, shares some themes with Hawken's book, and a sea that's usurped the land really is now the site of most territorial conflict in the world. And that's absolutely, you know, true because of all the overlapping jurisdictions in the sea. And there are many authors in Hawken's book which talk about this, the changed laws of the sea in which islands and coastlines now have overlapping jurisdictions. And it was really about the time that I was working on Enduring Innocence that Vajanthi and I also, who's one of the speakers and one of the contributors to this book, when was it? Was it sort of 2004 or 2005 when we did a conference about maritime space called Enclave at Yale. And Alan Sekula came, he was, of course, using the model of the sea to demonstrate, to counteract a kind of enthusiasm about digital virtual packets of information with evidence of heavy material trade, new networks of labor serving digital capital. Stefano Boeri came, and he had recently finished this project called Solid Sea, which was looking at the Mediterranean Sea as a solid, surveilled, controlled space. Someone else, a wonderful scholar named Shengming Chen, who was studying, among other things, cross-national growth zones in the South China Sea and around the Tumen River. It's the places where, you know, there are many different free zones and someone wants to make a tennis shoe, and so they send it round to different places to take advantage of different forms of lawlessness and quotas and so on. And then it was also great that Peter Lamborn Wilson, a.k.a. Hakim Bey, author of Pirate Utopias, came also to characterize the disposition of the sea in terms of the enclaves of pirates who would retire in the confetti of empire, where there would be honor among thieves. At a time when piracy was resurging, with a resurgence in piracy, and Sina, speaking of confetti of empire, then published a piece right after that, and an entire issue on the sea, a published piece of mine on Nauru, which is a sort of crazy island in Oceania. But one could certainly use, and it is a confetti of empire, but one could certainly use these mythomaniacal islands like Nauru as an index of all of the things that go on in the sea, from environmental disaster to offshore, many kinds of offshore activities. Quiche is another one we could look at for that kind of island activity. So there was something refreshing about simply looking at evidence of the sea without the overdramatic play of metaphors. Although I have to say that recently, it's maybe one too many things, but recently I've been thinking about that contrast between Jacques Rancière and Carl Schmitt's understanding of what the shore is in the sea. You know, for Rancière, the sea is a kind of pure demos. He says, what does he say? The sea smells of sailors. It smells of democracy. And the shore is that place which must always encounter democracy, must always resist consensus with some kind of dissensus. And then the sort of chilling comparison of that with Carl Schmitt's shoreless sea, a lawlessness that comes from, could come from either totalitarian power or political liberalism. That's the chilling collapse. Since working on Enduring Innocence, I've been working on a new book called Global Infrastructure, called Extra Statecraft, Global Infrastructure and Political Arts, that looks more at using the free zone as an index of that sea space. I notice in your subtitle you have ports, or I think ports or something. But the free zone is really one of the most contagious urban paradigms in the world that began with the sort of free ports of the Hanseats and Easterlings, and then became part of U.S. law in 1934, and then began to swallow manufacturing in maquiladoras, then became a model of free market, a sort of free market zone in China, at which point it took off, at which point it swallowed the city, became a UNIDO-backed paradigm for opening new markets all around the world. And it has not only swallowed the city, but swallowed every conceivable program that, of course, would love to exist in a lawless tax holiday. That's just part of another network of other zones in a great big sea. It's even, surpassing irony, swallowed the national capital, as in the case of Astana, or it's become a double of cities like Seoul. It's interesting, I'll just finish with this, that the sea image is not exactly persistent. With the most persistent image in all these zone cities is to portray themselves as places that are at the center of, at the center of the planet. As you'll see here with King Abdullah Economic City. I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of new free zone cities in the world. It's coming up where you'll see. There's the planet. But now, as the zone has become a kind of double, either of the national capital or of a major city, Navi Mumbai. This is King Abdullah Economic City. So it's now the glittering mimic of Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai. Or another double. This is New Songdo City, a double of Seoul. It's the place where you can do your extraterritorial dealings. New Songdo is designed by KPF to mimic Venice and New York and Sydney. It has a canal street, it has a Central Park, it has a World Trade Tower, and it too has again, the planetary image is the one that seems most dominant, palpitating urbanism. Anyway, that's some evidence I thought I could put on the table to compliment your very, very nice book. Congratulations.
Thank you, Hakan, and also to Alex and Keller for setting up really interesting kinds of, what Keller calls evidence for the sea. I mean, it's one of those things that I don't really work on as an object myself, but thanks to the project that Keller and I did, the conference we organized 1,000 years ago, really, it came to my attention as not as a metaphor, but as a kind of a space adjoining, to use Alex's language, a space adjoining the city and urbanism. So when Hakan asked me to contribute to the project, I turned to numerous kinds of adjacencies that I was familiar with to set up what I would like to think of as the sea being good to think with, right? So contrary to just being a metaphor, but in a kind of a classic, anthropological metaphor, where we have, people have written about pigs being good to think with and gifts being good to think with and so forth. I started wondering what the sea was good to think with, what the sea was good for to think with. And firstly I turned immediately to the figure that was much more familiar to me, that is the city, and to ask how the working of the city as a system and as a network might illuminate what about the sea was good to think with. So a classic image of the metropolis continues to dominate our imaginary about infrastructure, about the urban, contrary to the evidence that is so familiar from the evidence that, in fact, Keller has just put on the table. When it comes to studying places like Mumbai, which is, where I hang my hat, people are still trying to think with this notion of the metropolis. The metropolis, specifically as an articulation of a surface or of the city with an underground or its infrastructure. The city's reality is correlated to the functioning of this underground, its smoothnesses and its striations. The underground's layout differentiates geographies. Low-lying, flood-prone land, land adjoining railway tracks and airport runways, marshy, swampy land, and other compromised environments appear as a ground against which the figure of the service city and its bourgeois citizenry stand out as ideals, and they still do stand out as such. Shadow cities proliferate on this ground, exploiting differences in social, economic, and aesthetic value to survive and produce the bourgeois city as a machine. New technologies now allow a different city to emerge from these shadows, allowing the shadow geography created by the underground's layout to bear the weight of the fully built-up city. And this is the sort of free zone city that Keller was speaking about. Of millions, a city of millions of square meters resting on uncertain and contingent ground, bringing to light what was once the underground and its outgrowth. So the underground process, the infrastructural underground of the metropolis processes from a medium of the good city and good citizenship to a real that is in and of itself, one whose subjection to contingency is in plain sight. So this is what the city itself has become. The city is no longer an articulation of a surface and an underground, but all that there is may be visible in plain sight. The underground is no longer a medium, no longer a process of mediation that results in the particular representation of the good city, but the real that has itself become so real, having being in and of itself. The image of the metropolis then no longer holds, and yet we hold on to it, because it explains to some extent our fascination with trying to find political solutions that can actually restore our faith in the good city and the good citizen. A similar thing I argued in the paper that is part of the volume is happening with the sea itself. There's a procession, it seems, from it being a representation of various kinds of processes, of being a medium in which these processes happen, to becoming a kind of a generative surface of mediation, a surface on which mediation is in plain sight. And to sort of argue that point, I turn to a few examples, a couple of which I'll just place on the table here today. The one example that was at the time very much in the a year ago, very much front and center, that sort of reflects on this process of a movement from a system being a medium to being mediation, a generative form of mediation itself, was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill that had taken place earlier last year. And I turned to the work of an anthropologist working on this Deepwater Horizon spill called David Bond, who argued that there was a new view of the sea emerging as an object of scientific research, transforming ideas about its systemic nature. He wrote that federal responses to the spill were governed by the Oil Pollution Act, OPA, of 1990, which was written in the wake of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Applying intelligence from that spill, which was caused by an oil tanker running aground, officials initially treated the Deepwater Horizon event in exactly the same way, looking for liquid oil on the surface of the sea. Bond argued that this approach turned out to be inadequate to the new realities that were being revealed by the oil spill, which was caused by new technologies that enabled oil prospecting at hitherto unexplored depths. At those depths, crude is no longer a liquid substance, but a complex chemical substance that is partly gaseous, partly molecular substance, undetectable by scientific instruments that primarily rely on optics. Response to the spill required both a new way of conceptualizing crude as substance, as well as a new form of evidence gathering that relied, for example, on acoustic signals rather than visual signals to detect oil at these great depths. One of the hardest things about studying the largest oil spill in US history, Bond wrote, was actually finding it. So, of course, you know, the knowledge of what this spill consists of is vital to questions of compensation and social justice. But the course of producing evidence made the catastrophe actual or real by introducing new protocols for creating facts, ones that broke from the visual aesthetic conventions that gave reality to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The Deepwater Horizon event led to reassessment of the ocean itself as a system. From being conceptualized as a medium that contained life and provided passage to all kinds of other life forms and objects, including the passage of liquid forms of oil, the event brought to the fore a systemic view of the ocean as a network of life forms whose differences from each other can only be detected by passing the combinatorial logics of geochemistry rather than the visual aesthetic distinctions that we have become so familiar with. I considered this example to be a vital sort of moment where our thought itself, our process of thinking about the sea as an object itself could be measured in new terms. So, for instance, this kind of example provides us evidence for rethinking the notion of an autopoietic system as a network, rather than as a system which is governed by transcendental laws or laws of mediation that place at their center certain forms of human control and subjectivity, rather than relying on an idea of a network as a kind of a coalition of forces that are in and of themselves speculative. So what kind of a world does that lead us? Where does that lead us in terms of where we are today? If we use this kind of an example to think with, I think about the ways in which it reflects our relationship to new forms of urbanism, new forms of inhabiting these sort of vast systemic conurbations. It leads me to think that we need to reassess where we are as far as our, Keller has again already put this on the table, as far as thinking about what it means for us to think about politics today in inhabiting these kinds of systems where the where seas or cities are coalitions or intricate compositions of contingent forces without really where stable communicative mediums are actually being compromised on an everyday basis. So what kind of politics is possible in this sort of a situation? So again, for me, as I said, the edge between the sea and the city is one of those edges that makes it makes visible the kind of ways of managing these contradictions between mediation, a continuous process of mediation, and imagining the city or the sea as the as mediums of some other sort of process. For example, in a colonial port city like Mumbai, the port was itself concealed from the rest of the city by means of walls. The walls served to veil and to mask the extraction of resources from the colony and their setting sail to distant destinations. Activities on the docks were therefore off limits to residents, and the urban experience was contained, localized, and dominated by the image of the textile mill, which was the quintessential site of labor exploitation. In recent years, the detachment of the port from its activities of circulation, because vessels have become too large for this port to handle, has paradoxically led to a freeze on the docklands as a possible site for imaginaries of urban renewal, in sharp contrast to the gentrification strategies pursued by cities like London and New York and so forth. In these, yet these lands attached to the sea are enabling the circulation of Mumbai as a space where global flows of wealth and management and investment might fruitfully converge and profit simultaneously from extremely low labor costs on the one hand and extremely high real estate values on the other hand. This edge where the where land and sea meets, veiled as it is within a colonial geography of separation, conceals a vast land bank while keeping it just enough in view of speculators, enabling them to profit from the scarcity created artificially by banking thousands of acres of docklands. In the meanwhile, these lands and their character of being secret terrain are put to use in the exploitation of labor in highly contested forms of industrial work, such as shipbreaking. The edge has therefore become embroiled in a logic of anticipation. Anticipation itself is located within, has a very, very specific place within our episteme of modernity. It's unquestionable within this logic that the whether or not the future can be anticipated. The future anticipation of modern knowledge systems, however, draws increasingly on uncertainty rather than on certainty about the future. And these kinds of speculative forecasts, which are based completely on, which in fact draw on and are based on uncertainty, have become the main medium of projection into the future. So this form of forecasting goes along with a fundamental transformation in the idea of the real itself. From the possibility that that contingency is that a system is shaped by contingent events, we have now moved to a situation where the real itself is contingent or appears to be contingent without any kind of grounding in a law of necessity. The problem with speculative forecast, however, is that it must be managed and controlled paradoxically by resort to a conception of reality that is able to transcend contingency. And this to me is part of the explanation for why we get these kind of dramatic metaphors of the sea as a space, as a smooth, frictionless space of market making or of revolution. And such a conception of reality is secured by the fictions of a smooth system operating without resort to masking the actual nature of the contingencies that affect the system. But there are moments at which this friction constantly breaks down. And it is in these moments that excessive speculation comes to the fore as an explanatory mechanism. Here, speculative forecasting is simply seen, for instance, as in the financial crisis, in the recent financial crisis, speculative forecasting is simply seen as crude and calculative logics taken to an extreme, rather than as a form of knowledge that imbues the very logic of future anticipation in a world saturated with uncertainty. This, of course, leaves room to return to ideas of planning and management as a way of leading ourselves out of the messiness of speculative thinking. Contemporary politics often appears as a farce teetering between episodes of such management gone bad, where secrecy and transparency appear to perform the same role vis-a-vis the conversion of speculative reason into transcendent certainties of the logics of modern systemic realities. The management of the sea in contemporary maritime trade practice, and specifically its peculiar visuality, once again reveals this kind of politics at work. I don't have the images, but they are in the book, images from a software called the Vessel Tracker software, which are available to the public, in fact, which, like Google Earth images, are interesting points of departure. These images reveal holding patterns of ships off of the world's busiest ports, where only active ships, or the ones being loaded and unloaded, enter the harbor, while the ships waiting to carry trade remain in a holding pattern just outside of the harbor, outside of the view of ordinary people. Thus, the availability of visual data from Vessel Tracker presents the real or the actual condition of global trade in a transparent fashion, while the view from the harbor with inactive ships just out of sight masks this very condition from those who are not actively looking. Like Vessel Tracker visualization software, other instances of visualization build an aesthetics of interconnection that is simultaneously transparent and capable of disruption, as well as mysterious and concealing. These contradictory oscillations between visibility and invisibility, and between secrecy and transparency, are therefore the structuring contradictions that are regularly mobilized by an economic logic of speculative forecasting, of future anticipation, in order to project a fiction of frictionless circulation or exchange, that is, to project a real that has transcended contingency by calculating correctly. When such projections fail and these contradictions are exposed, speculative forecasting is blamed for causing such failure. In other words, an ethical structure of blame and judgment is easily imposed on the event. What such blame masks, however, is how common speculative forecasting has become within a structure of reality in which the real is not anchored by any laws of necessity as stable systems, which can be reshaped, but is fundamentally an outgrowth of contingent events. And this is where I'll end by saying that, you know, part of this journey of working through these examples has been to sort of think through what it is that that the sea is good to think with.
As I said at the beginning, we started the project like 2009. Being in Istanbul, looking at Istanbul after 2001, the financial crisis in Turkey happened in 2001. So the banking system is overhauled. There's IMF and World Bank stepped in. So 2002, there was the new government. Neoconservative government took over. So therefore, like in last 10 years, we were kind of experiencing the effects of the crisis already. So the Istanbul and Turkey in general went through this fundamental changes, and in terms of like privatization and restructuring the society. So being in Istanbul, of course, it's impossible not to pay attention of all these development projects because they are heavily advertised. And Istanbul, I mean, being an old port city, and this old ports are located in the center, right? One of the ports, Haydarpaşa, it is, and the Galata port, they stay in the one of the prime real estate, but being heavily utilized by the shipping industries. So what they want to do basically like to completely transform these areas. But this imagination, I think we were kind of like taking away by the ideas of like circulating on the internet because these were not the real projects. But these were the kind of imaginary projects that government was assigning some people to produce so that it will create some sort of a common base to accept these development projects. And of course, they will remind you this, the projects of Dubai, but also this, Ottoman, the nostalgia embedded with the shopping mall aesthetic, right? So, and of course, you look at it, when you look at all these images, it is impossible not to recognize the imagination. Imagination in terms of not the aesthetic of the building or the landscape design, but the people. Who are those people who are going to utilize those spaces are imagined as well. So, of course, there are some other projects that are a little bit more serious than these kind of like sketches. And Zaha Hadid is doing the Kartal area, this whole urban redevelopment, if you will. I mean, you may argue it's good or bad or whatever it is, but these architects are partnering with the neoconservative government to utilize some sort of mass redevelopment projects. When we talk about neoliberalism, it is impossible not to quote David Harvey, who says that the capital always moves in like to tsunami, right? The image of the sea rushing in. The capital is rushing in and leaving a devastation behind. So how is this devastation is manifested in the real spaces? And we were kind of lucky that once we first developed this project in Istanbul, then we were invited by an art organization, Sextant et Plus, from Marseille, to do a short 15 days art in residency. So we were kind of want to develop this project further, but we didn't know what to expect, right? Of course, we knew that the idea of the immigrant population and then being the entry point for the immigrants in Europe, we had some initial ideas. But when you walk around the port areas, right? This is the old city, there's the port, and then you see these development projects, right? They are also marketed. Similar to Istanbul, and you can see that there are a lot of advertisement going on because the Marseille as a city is also going through this huge kind of gentrification, right? So when we were walking around, you see a little, a tiny bit of a graffiti, La Ville Blanc. So I'm going to read what we wrote after that because I think it better explains. As part of the second leg of the Sea Marble project, we had the chance to conduct research in the port of Marseille and its surroundings. For the exhibition, we realized at Sextant et Plus, La Friche, we chose the title La Ville Blanc from a graffiti tagged on such an architectural rendering of a development project to be realized within the city center of Marseille. It seems that the term La Ville Blanche characterizes an imminent mistake, which is, I studied French, my French was really bad, but I was glad that I recognized this mistake, which is not directly translatable to Turkish or English. The gendered disposition of language underlines the patrimonial politics of development and gentrification. La ville, a feminine word, is accompanied by a masculine term, blanc, instead of blanche. This at first appeared to be just a mistake, right? But a grammatical error clearly indicating that the owner of the graffiti is not language proficient. However, blanc, the masculine form of a city located of a development plan for a new corporate trade center, initiates a very precise critique. When walking in Marseille, we came upon this billboard as a vision of things to come and realize the similarities between other images in different cities of the world, an affluent all-white imagining of an exclusive urban life, from New York to Istanbul, from Izmir to New Orleans. Here, our aim is not to make an ethno-racial claim. Yet, it is important to identify the overlapping class dispositions on the racial, gendered articulation of bodies in the neoliberal reimagination of cities. This conservative reimagination is mostly articulated by high-end design, which function as a form of neoliberal packaging. In fact, the de facto failure of these projects lie just on the surface of these architectural renderings that simply ignore and exclude. And it seems that the strategy of the new bourgeoisie is more efficient, rather violent, than direct antagonistic racist encounters in the cities compared to fascist violence that constantly happens in various parts of the Europe. Then you can fight against them, you can claim your resistance. Whereas these developments, we found that it is extremely powerful in terms of rearticulating of the city design and city planning by simply pushing the residents out. And if you remember from the New Orleans, like after the Katrina, they used the Katrina to reimagine the city and demolish the public housing. And they demolished 4,500 apartments just to open a space for the new development in the city. So what does it mean to look at the city now? I mean, like, to see now. I talk about the, like, of course, always this coastal regions that is being like a repackaged, right? So in 2009, we decided to utilize the Topkapı Palace. It's the one of the most tourist attraction in Istanbul, right? Every tourist has to go there because it is the prime real estate, if you will, right? It is built on top of the Byzantium Palace. It's demolished and the top Ottomans built their own palace. And it has this imperial vista. And at the time, of course, in Istanbul, this the sea, the idea of sea is always attached to this idea of monster coming from the sea, because the Anatolian fault line starts from Marmara Sea. Right, the seventh Richter scale earthquake, they say that it's going to bring the demolition, the whole city. And then they are expecting that over 100,000 people will die, etc., etc. At the time, we were thinking about this idea of sea, how it's like this Leviathan, right? This is this monster coming out of the sea and taking away everything that you have. But also the seas, as we see it, when you look at the southeast of Turkey, from this imperial vista, this beautiful vista. So I have to play this. Oh, it's playing. That's good. It's a 5-minute video. We shot this. There's no sound, but I can still talk. In an extremely foggy day, so you could see nothing. But like we precisely directed our camera towards the southeast, towards the Gaza. At the time, Israeli military was attacking Gaza. Thousands of people were dying. So we were thinking that this, what in around Mediterranean basin, what connects us? what makes us that unified, in a sense that what all these centuries, right? All the, and Brodel extensively talks about this free trade, this exchange of cultures over the centuries made Mediterranean culture. So looking at that, and then seeing nothing, but just like a very dim activity of the sea and some ships and birds, and we decided that this piece, the sea, looking at sea, it's always about some sort of a contemplation. You cannot show sea and give an example. There is this impossibility of the sea presents itself, but also it hides it. When it hides it, actually it is this metaphorical aspect of it that allows us to think about a lot of issues at once. So that's why we said that looking at to the southeast from the Ottoman palace, this imperial vista allows us to meditate all these things that I just talked about. So in Marseille, obviously, this is a 6-minute video. In Marseille, obviously, the situation is not like the one that is presented in the architectural renderings. When you look at walk around the cities, like Marseille, like Athens that we have been and did some research, in Istanbul, in New York, in New Orleans, you see people, you see real activity, real exchange going on. I'm not trying to like kind of nostalgify of these activities. I don't say that these are good people. I don't want to make this moral judgment. These people are there and they are doing because of the conditions that are imposed to them. So instead of this whole neoliberal agenda, instead of understanding the conditions that people are living in and trying to develop projects, these imaginary projects that we criticize all along, right? The modernization and Marseille, there are a couple of Le Corbusier, right? There are a couple of Le Corbusier buildings actually like a public housing projects. And we all claim that they failed. So in the failure of the modernization project, the neoliberal projects take over and then takes it to the extreme right in a way. Right. So anyway, similar to Ellen Shekula and a lot of like other artists like Ursula Biemann, we didn't want to just speculate about what all these about, right? We want to see, we want to talk with people, but our artistic project is nothing about like interviewing people, asking their opinion. Like we are not, as I said, we are not interested in people's like ideas. We are interested in like talking to them. We are interested in their ideas in the sense that we are interested to learn from them, but not to present them in the project, but rather we want to make a kind of a gesture, right? So looking at these spaces, this is from Athens. And Athens, by the way, like a kind of conflicted all idea of neoliberal transformation. So we expected, we had the assumption that Athens would follow the examples of its big brothers, right? Istanbul, New York, let's gentrify everything. But when there is no capital influx, then you cannot gentrify. So what happens then? The social state already pulled itself out. So there is no capital influx, there is no development, so then you leave people to basically in a way the suffering, right? So and we look at it and then we realize that these objects, like these products, like they are the kind of like a symbols, but the metaphors of like money. It's a symbol, but it carries itself around the world. And these are counterfeit, like counterfeit money. It also represents something. Represent that something that does not work at that point, right? You see a lot of counterfeit products in Istanbul and in Athens, not in Marseille that much. So we decided that I mean, like looking at these objects, looking at all these like things happening around the port, we wanted to go into the port and then see, experience what's going on in it. So that we did some video projects alongside it. I'm not showing here, but this extreme, like this is in Athens as well, but in Istanbul and New York is the same. This extreme activity, but very precise, very calculated. Like Keller also talks about that in her book. So in the exhibition, we decided to the idea of contemplation come into the idea of the accumulations. So what you can accumulate about the sea? When you're looking at the sea, you have to, it's kind of a typology, right? You see certain things. But is it possible to put them together? Like when you go to in a market, you realize that they're all together at once. And this fragmentation, we thought that that is the that kind of, instead of finding a vista, like imperial vista that we found from Ottoman Palace and looking to something very precise, when you're looking at sea, when you're thinking about these products and containers and objects, requires much fragmented approach. So we decided to do these typologies, looking at sky, standing next to the shore, but looking at different directions. So sky, water, earth, fish, and also fish comes, and also it's scary, certain fish, and shoes, container. So we developed these six basically categories, and we work as a collective. So we kind of assign this as a collective image finding, like everybody assign and do as much as fish and container and water or sky possible in the port cities at that particular time. So we did like 6,000 photographs. And if the photographs, the exhibition, the installation happened with this is La Ville Blanc in Marseille, alongside with the details of from the billboards. And these photographs are like presented, 6,000 photographs and videos are presented, printed on 4x6 paper. Presented is kind of like a kind of a sea, so people could see and touch and look at the individual images and photographs and kind of contemplate themselves. And in Athens, the contemplation comes at a cost because all of them gone in 15 days. People take it as a souvenir, I think. So these are shoes, fish, and that's it. So thank you very much. Now we can... maybe you want we can have the questions. And do you want to come here? No. Okay, that's fine. Any questions? Yes, please.
I have a question for anyone who presented. We heard about the sea as smooth capitalism. We heard about the sea as imaginary side of revolution. The sea as lawlessness or Leviathan. I just wondered if there was any resource in another idea of the sea, which is actually related to some of these others. See as, I think in Roman law, it was part of the res nullius, you know, the thing of no one. The sea is commons. If there's any way to motivate that old idea against these other ideas, so we're not just left with these dichotomies. Smooth flows, lawlessness, does that come up in the book, or no, does that come up in your work at all?
Well, it's always been staked out. I mean, you know, the sort of hilarious, the Grotius text of his hilarious text that the Dutch, that it's natural for the Dutch to have control over the whole sea, but it's not natural for the Portuguese to have control over the whole sea. But it, you know, there are just piles and piles and piles of throughout history of only that, right? Of continual striation and overstriation of the sea. And it's true, very little. And discussions of it as a commons, but a commons that can be monopolized by someone, you know. So I'm having a hard time thinking of something that is. I mean, there is in law, the sense that it there is some British law that it is that the sea is exterior to law, so that's why you know what would you do with a pirate and so on. But a commons. I'm having a hard time thinking of many examples.
Any other questions?
This might connect up with that, which is, and Keller, I wanted to ask if you had any. I mean, you mentioned Grotius just now and the idea of the free seas, and you talked about those free zones as doing extraterritorial work. And I wondered if in your work for the Extra Statecraft Project you were beginning to tie up the history of maritime spaces as a kind of extraterritory. The idea that, you know, Dutch and British mercantilism depends upon the creation of these free avenues for movement, and as you just pointed out, it's not exactly a commons because there's a desire to exploit and to monopolize that space, but there is still at least a claim that it's not territorializable, right? That one can't actually designate it as part of the sovereign map of nations. It's not reducible to a territorial political geography. So is there a link, either historically or in terms of the sort of theoretical model you're trying to do, between that conception of the ocean as an extraterritorial space for the movement of goods and of capital, and the development of these, whether they're port cities, whether they're IT campuses, these free zones that you're thinking of in the Extra Statecraft Project?
They directly come from you know, the free ports of Genoa and the Hansa traders, and I mean all the way back into ancient history, they come into I mean Hamburg as one example of the Hansa traders was used. Some law, some specialized law was made for Hamburg as part of the Third Reich. And the United States modeled some of its free trade law on Hamburg, so as to make these kinds of duty-free, you know, compounds. The United Nations took that model and then decided, oh, this will be a great thing to promote around the world as a way of opening up markets or allowing developing countries to take on this little instrument, this little organ, even though they quickly recognized that it was a completely suboptimal economic organ that only allowed, you know, a country to create have a kind of separate authority for all kinds of cheating, basically. And so in a way, it's a contemporary instrument that is now filled with everything. With the city, with anything that wants to cheat, and then even as I was saying, a national capital. There's a national capital as its own, exempt from the very laws of the state. You know, so it swallowed the capital, because everybody wants to have that space, that extraterritorial space for doing the things you need to do, to have your shadow presence, and more there are doubles of major cities as zones. I don't know if that does anything to. Maybe that's.
Any other questions?
I just had a comment. far simpler, about the way that the sea, how much we don't see what's going on in the sea, and how interesting it is that in, during the 20th, because really what happened under the sea was very much a matter of the 20th century, where the first submarine real explorations could be made. But we always imagine the sea, we look at it in this contemplative way as a flat thing, and then we realize that there was all this life, all this that was going underneath the sea, and now what's being apparent is all that is going over the sea in terms of transportation and capitals and so on, that yet we don't see because they're removed from. It's as if what's happening on Earth, on land, was far more accessible to our view than what's happening in that vast scape that is still so beyond the borders, and that is so, that then gives way to, its power comes from its lack of visibility, and that's why it invokes such imaginary, you know, evokes such imaginary and appeals to our imaginary so much, because it's always, it's again, it's like the unconscious, it's what we don't see. It's all that's happening there, and also it's becoming more and more the place for refuse, for toxic refuse. So that's one thing that kind of came up in tonight that was really interesting, that I had never really thought of so much of, you know, as this place that we don't see as much. And the other thing that is really interesting is, and that I don't think was discussed as much, although I think you implied it in your presentation, is the porosity of the shores, and the way that with the rising of the sea level, with global warming, the ports are going to start to be obsolete, and it's kind of really interesting that there's all this development in places that are really destined to last very little. So I just had those comments.
Thank you very much for coming. We can continue our talks during our reception. We have some food in the back, sorry, and then some beer. Thank you.